Support for WERU comes from the 2019 North Atlantic Blues Festival at Harbor Park in Rockland, Maine, July 13th and 14th, featuring live blues performances from Ruthie Foster, Sugar Ray Rayford, Rick Estrin and the Nightcats, The Proven Ones, as well as Carolyn Wonderland and more. Tickets and information at NorthAtlanticBluesFestival.com.
It's 10 o'clock, and you are tuned to WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill and streaming online at WERU.org. Power for the People with your host Steve Call is up next.
Good morning. This is Power for the People. I'm your host, Steve Call. It's always good to listen to Freddie on the way in the morning, on my way into the studio. And the fact that Yes was playing in the background in that promo a moment ago was an unexpected nice thing as well. So the Power for the People's intention is to help Mainers understand and take control of their energy future. And I think this is a really important show to get to that perspective, because we're going to talk about the wrap-up of the legislative session that just ended. And we have a couple of really good people to talk about that. First of all, in the studio with me is Representative Nicole Grochowski of Ellsworth, who is a member of the Joint Standing Committee on Energy, Utilities, and Technology. Thank you for being here, Nicole.
Thank you for having me.
And on the phone is, I believe, is Sophie Janeway, who is the Clean Energy Outreach Coordinator at the Natural Resource Council of Maine in Augusta. Sophie, are you there?
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks so much for being willing to be on the program. And in the interest of full disclosure, when I have somebody from NRCM on, I do say that I am a lifetime member of NRCM, which has nothing to do with the fact that I invited you on, of course. It's that you're knowledgeable about these things. Given that Sophie is on the phone, do be aware that our two telephone lines, she is occupying one of them. And so if you do call in, and get a busy signal, that's because there's somebody else on the phone, and do hang in there and try again. So again, wrap up of the legislative session. So Nicole, I just introduced you as the member of the Joint Standing Committee on Energy and Utilities and Technology. Tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Thank you so much, Steve. That is true. I am a newly elected representative serving Ellsworth and Trenton in the State House, and I was fortunately given my first choice of committee, which is the Energy, Utilities, and Technology Committee, and I'm happy to have served in the past few months to really move us forward on these topics, not just energy, of course, but also some of our broadband and other internet policy as well. So it's been a really exciting first session for me.
And as a paddler, I do have to say, as I understand it, you were the first woman to paddle the Northern Forest Canoe Trail solo.
That is not true.
That is not true?
Oh. First woman to paddle the Northern Forest Canoe Trail, but I did do it with a friend of mine, Tom Perkins, also of Ellsworth.
Okay, well, that's either way, that's great. And Sophie, so again, Clean Energy Outreach Coordinator at NRCM, tell us a little bit more about yourself and give us a nickel tour of what NRCM is all about.
Well, so NRCM is the state's leading environmental advocacy group with 20,000 members and supporters across the state. And we work with Maine people to empower their voices and bring their voices into the State House to pass policies that help protect Maine's environment. And my role on our clean energy project is really connecting those people to the State House and generating their support for all these exciting initiatives that the legislature gets to move forward.
All right, and NRCM certainly is a major player in dealing with the various energy issues out there. So I'll just mention to the engineer, right, that Nicole cannot hear Sophie, and let me get that. I can hear Sophie fine. So sorry for this slight blip here. All right, so what I'd like to start off with, I mean, we've got a list of legislative actions that have been signed by the governor that we do want to talk about here, but I'd like to start by asking each of you kind of to give me an overview of what you think the most significant changes are for individuals and or businesses, and start with you, Nicole, and what do you think are the most important ones, and again, coming back to the purpose of this program to help Mainers understand the energy climate and their cost of energy.
I would say that probably LD 1711 was one of the top bills that we had, and that legislation has to do with expanding our renewable energy through solar installations, but also other distributed generation that might qualify for that. So we want to stay technology neutral to the extent that we can when we create legislation, so that if there are other renewables that come in that are competitive, that we not just create policy specifically for one type. However, solar right now is one of our most competitive renewable energies, so I think a lot of that legislation will result in solar installations. One of the exciting parts of that legislation is that originally, if people wanted to work together to create a community solar installation and share the benefits of building a bigger installation, they might be able to on their house, for instance. We used to have a cap of only 10 people and 660 kilowatts for those installations. And we got I know that it's been a process over the past few years to try to increase that. And so we have actually increased it to a total of just under 5 megawatt size installation, and an unlimited number of members can be involved. And we think that that will be self-limiting to the extent that you wouldn't really want to join a cooperative where you'd only save a dollar on your electricity bill. So we don't expect that there will be a million people building a 5 megawatt resource, but we just really thought that there was no reason to have an arbitrary cap on something like that. So that's really going to help people who maybe aren't well sited for solar, or people who live in mobile home parks, for instance, to join together and get a more efficient installation and save money on their electricity bills. And another part of that legislation just has to do with procurement of renewable energy that will be overseen by the Public Utilities Commission. So that will move us toward our goals of more, renewable portfolio standards, which is another bill that we had in as well this year. So we are moving through that legislation to basically 80% renewable energy by 2030, and we have specified steps in that legislation to get us there, and then 100% renewable electricity by 2050. And what I should say is that's electricity that's purchased by main ratepayers. So that doesn't include the energy that we use to power our cars, for instance, or to heat our homes, unless we're heating with electricity. So we do have more steps to take in order to get those things electrified and as part of the grid, so that we can use renewable energy for them. But as we do that, we have goals set up to bring us to those higher standards. Right now, we're at 40% renewable energy in our electricity grid. So to go from 40 to 80 in 10 years is really, I think, a huge step forward for Maine.
Right. And of course, there are states and in particular cities out there. There's something over 100 cities right now that have already committed to 100% renewable energy. And so, in fact, it is the direction that that we are moving as a society, as we've talked about in this program numerous times. And interestingly, back, this has been in the news recently that listeners may have seen it in April. We made the transition to renewable energy generating more electricity than coal did finally in the U.S. So that's that was, again, pardon me for saying it, but a positive step. So, Sophie, what's your perspective on most significant changes for individuals or businesses?
Well, I think Nicole really hit the nail on the head with overviewing those few bills. We have not had such an opportunity through legislative action to move the needle on clean energy in quite some time. So it's really exciting to see how many people got involved in the legislative session and came out and spoke up, and how much overwhelming bipartisan support there was for these bills. Nicole did a great job of recapping the benefits of the solar energy bill, which is going to reduce barriers for homeowners and other residents and municipal customers and commercial customers. So I want to just touch base on the renewable portfolio standard bill and specifically on our climate, Governor Mills' climate action bill. So the renewable portfolio standard bill sets a target of 100% renewable energy by 2050 and requires 80% renewable energy by 2030. And, you know, in coordination with that, a bill which was not in front of the Energy, Utilities, and Technology Committee, but a different legislative committee, was focusing on addressing climate change and how we can reach 80% reductions by 2050 and 80% reductions in carbon pollution. And that'll really help promote clean energy jobs and also establishes the Maine Climate Council, which was Governor Mills's initiative to bring in a diverse set of stakeholders to update the state's climate action plan. And the significance of this bill can really not be overstated. It is the most significant action on climate change that the state has taken in over a decade, and it's an incredible opportunity to grow our economy and transition to more clean energy and really address the impacts of climate change that Maine is already seeing.
That sounds great, and we certainly will come back and touch on both of these in a few moments here. You mentioned bipartisanship, Sophie, and I have to say, as somebody who does pay attention to the news, especially on energy-related things, it didn't seem all that controversial that we were doing things so differently than has been done in the last 8 years. And I guess, Nicole, I want to start with you since you were there and talking with your committee members. I mean, some of the bills that we're going to talk about here, in fact, had lead sponsorship by Republicans. How bipartisan was this, and were there things that were controversial?
That's a great question. I would say I was really impressed being new to the legislature and having sort of followed the solar bills over the past few years and the contentious issues and not being able to quite get the votes, that things went pretty smoothly this session. And as you said, LD 1711, for instance, was sponsored by Senator Dow, who is a Republican from Lincoln County, and really had a champion in Senator Woodsum of York County, who serves on my committee as the Senate Republican. Both of those gentlemen certainly see the value for Maine to be more energy independent and to create new clean energy jobs. And so they were definitely champions within the Senate that helped move the legislation forward. And it was great to work with them and to come all together with a common understanding of how this is the direction that we're headed and how can we do it appropriately for our economy. So it was really great to work with them and encouraging, I think, that we have a shared vision for Maine's energy future.
And I have to say, as a native Mainer, I have to say I'm proud of the fact that it worked this way, because as near as I can tell that it did, and frankly, I'm not sure that it would have worked this well in Washington, D.C. if we'd been doing the same sort of level of effort in Washington. Sophie, what's your perspective more broadly on bipartisanship and Republican support?
Well, you know, I think it's a reflection of the strong support for clean energy across the state, you know, regardless of age, regardless of level of education, regardless of level of income, political party, geographic location in the state, Maine people are overwhelmingly in support of solar energy, and that has become overwhelmingly apparent throughout the last 8 years, and it was finally able to come to fruition this year. So I think it's really exciting that the legislature is reflecting this broad support on the ground.
And it's certainly true that these types of bills have been passed by the legislature over the last 8 years and vetoed, and in many or most of them have been upheld. The vetoes have been upheld for various political reasons, just to get the facts out there, not expressing an opinion about it in particular. All right, so we'll open the phones now, since we've kind of touched on a couple things, in particular solar PV, and we'll talk on that here shortly. More details, but the phone number here is 469-0500 or 866-625-9378. And again, we have one phone line open for callers, and so if you do get a busy signal, try again, please. So I do think that LD 1711 is probably the one that we need to focus on here first. And so my big, and I have to say, in reading legislation, it's not always entirely clear to me where the details are. Does this bill repeal or reestablish net metering the way it was originally operating before the PUC put in gross metering?
That's a great question. This is Nicole. This bill does not, because we took action earlier in the session to remove that gross metering provision from the PUC, and that law takes effect 90 days after adjournment. But because of the fact that the Public Utilities Commission could see that we were moving away from gross metering back to net metering, they have suspended their gross metering rules, and so people are no longer being required to install these additional meters to calculate how much energy they're producing and using behind the meter. So effectively, it has gone into effect at this point. That was a separate piece of legislation.
Because of PUC action. Mm-hmm. And what was the legislation that actually did that? Sorry to put you on the spot,
okay.
But I just haven't found it, and so I wasn't sure.
Yeah, it happened, I don't know, if Sophie, if you know the number, it happened a few months ago. It was pretty early in the session we took that action, so.
It was LD 91, and it passed. It was one of the first exciting pieces.
Okay, I'll go back and look at that one, because I hadn't run into that yet. We have a caller on the line. Becky, you are on the air.
Hi, it's Becky Bartovic from Sierra Club, Maine. Really appreciate all the work that Sophie's been doing with NRCM. One of the bills that I'd love to have you talk about is 646. It was not in the EUT, but in the Environment Resources and Environment Natural Resources Committee, that was Brandy Carson's bill, that was looking at greenhouse gas emissions from the CMP transmission line.
I think we've lost you, Becky, but we have the essence of what you were talking about, and that is something that we did want to talk about, so let's just go there then. So LD 646, I believe, was a study bill for the CMP transmission line. Sophie, do you want to start on that one?
Yeah, I'm happy to speak to that. So it's actually LD 640, which was sponsored by Senator Brownie Carson, and it would have required a comprehensive independent analysis of the carbon and climate impacts of the proposed CMP corridor and transmission line project. And that did not end up passing through and becoming law. But what's been incredible to see over these past weeks and months and honestly years is that the opposition to this project just continues to grow. In the last 2 weeks alone, six more Maine towns voted in opposition of this project, and two major unions voted overwhelmingly to oppose the project. And the opposition just continues to build because people recognize that this project is a bad deal for Maine. And so it's really unfortunate that this legislation did not become law. Because I think that Maine people really deserve the answer to the question about the climate impacts of this proposed project. But there are still a lot of opportunities, a lot of permits that CMP needs to move forward. And so it's a continuing process, and it's exciting that people are continuing to get involved and speak up about their concerns.
Sophie, could you just go over the process that needs to happen now in terms of permits and approvals and the likely time frame? And then I'm going to come back and ask Nicole about the fact that the governor has come out in supporting this and what that might mean. But Sophie, tell us a little bit about the process and the timeline.
Yes, so the CMP corridor still faces a number of permitting requirements, federal and state. The Department of Environmental Protection is still going over all of the permitting decisions, and we expect a decision from them by this fall, and no earlier than that.
And can I just ask?
Oh, yeah.
So the DEP staff is working on that. The Board of Environmental Protection presumably has to approve their recommendation. Is that correct?
Don't want to be incorrect, so I think that may be how it works, but I'm not positive.
And you may know, and this is not this is off the topic of energy per se, except that it does relate to my question. I did see legislation out there entitled something like Strengthening the Board of Environmental Protection. I don't know what the backstory was there. Can you shed any light on that?
I am not familiar with the strengthening the Board of Environmental Protection.
Okay. Realize it's not necessarily in your job description, but as a former DEP employee myself, I was just interested in what that might mean. And of course, it does apparently or probably affect the CMP corridor. So sorry, I interrupted you there. So the DEP is involved. Who else?
And so the Federal Army Corps of Engineers CMP's corridor will require a permit from the Army Corps of Engineers. And the Environmental Protection Agency recently issued a letter expressing a lot of great concern about the proposed project and the environmental impacts of the project. And in addition, as I mentioned, towns continue to come out in opposition to this project.
Okay. And Nicole, the governor has come out in favor of it. What's the backstory there, and how is that likely to affect the process?
Well, first I should acknowledge that I don't know why anyone does anything in particular. Of course, I have opinions. We all have opinions on these issues. But the governor, this project does not need the governor's support in any way. So she has elected to make public her support, although she was not required to. And that should not influence the proceedings of the DEP, who should be acting independently. But whether or not it does, I can't say. For me, one of the concerns I have, and one of the reasons that LD 640, Senator Carson's bill, was so important to me and why I supported it, is because the governor has been making decisions related to the climate change impacts based on a study done by London Economics, which only looked at New England. And this energy that's being produced is being produced outside of New England. The energy is also being sold outside of New England, particularly to Ontario and to New York. And so to do a study that only looked at climate change benefits in New England doesn't take into account the fact that this energy could be wheeled, as they call it, from the places that it's currently being sold to Massachusetts in order for Massachusetts to get a climate benefit. So I have concerns about the fact that the study really doesn't take into account the full region at play here, and that is why Senator Carson's study was looking to do that. People have said that we shouldn't be worried because those two jurisdictions have strong clean energy standards, but that puts them in a position of needing to turn around and find energy really fast as well. So I think we need to think more broadly when we think about where we're going to get large sources of energy. And my other concern with the project in general is that we have made huge gains in this legislature to have more renewable distributed energy in Maine. We've also made gains regarding deep offshore wind and moving forward with the University of Maine's research and development project, which would be located off Monhegan Island. And these are opportunities for us to be real leaders in clean energy, not just in Maine, but in the region and in the world. So at the point when we connect to Hydro-Québec's resources and essentially encourage them to build more large-scale hydropower dams, I am concerned that we're precluding our own ability to generate clean energy in Maine and perhaps be not just a consumer, but also an exporter of that energy. So my concern is that we are possibly cutting ourselves out of a future possible exciting job market with a lot of economic opportunity for ourselves and for our university system.
Right. And my understanding is that there is not excess generation today. And I don't know if they plan to build new dams or not. But if they're diverting energy to Massachusetts from somebody else, that somebody else is going to have to find energy somewhere else, which may well not be renewable. So
correct.
That's the bigger picture that you just talked about. It's not just the New England market. And the other part of it is, for an environmental guy who does energy stuff, in general, I favor hydropower. But when you're damming the northern, the boreal forest and flooding wetlands, you're probably releasing a heck of a lot more methane.
Mm-hmm.
And methane is 82 times the power of CO2. And methane is the invisible climate change greenhouse gas that people don't talk about as much as we should. So I agree that the big picture here needs to be considered without a doubt. Any comment on that, Sophie?
Well, the only thing I'll add is that for Maine people, regardless of how you feel about hydropower, the energy shifting that Nicole spoke to, the fact that Hydro-Quebec does not have excess energy and that there is a shifting from energy that they're selling outside of New England into New England, the fact that it's shifting and that there's no new renewable energy being produced reflects a lack of climate benefits. And I think, you know, as Nicole said, the legislature has passed so much exciting renewable energy policy that allows Maine to capture the benefits of renewable energy jobs, economic development, and lowered energy costs, and, you know, benefiting from the clean energy transition in so many different ways. And so continuing to move forward on that seems like the best opportunity to benefit Maine.
Right. So I certainly would agree with that. So the renewable portfolio standard that both of you have alluded to, 80% by 2030, if I get that right, and 100% by 2050. Just to clarify, because it has come up in this program before, that in fact today Maine is about 70% renewable. The renewable portfolio standard, however, doesn't include pre-existing hydro.
So
go ahead.
I'd like to clarify that first statement. So that's the number that you said about 70%. That's what we generate in Maine. That's not what our electricity usage is, because we do get electricity from outside of Maine as part of the ISO New England grid. So that is a confusing point where we think, oh, we're doing really great with our generation, but our generation doesn't account for all of our usage of electricity. And then, of course, electricity is separate from the full energy standard, which would include, you know, fuel for transportation and home heating. So in that regard, we are one of the most dependent states for home heating oil in the country. So we'd like to be shifting away from that through heat pumps, which there was legislation about that as well, and other heating and transportation solutions. So as we're doing that, we want to make sure that the electricity that we're consuming, not just that we're generating, but that we're consuming, is reaching these high standards of renewable generation.
So does the renewable portfolio standard refer to electricity we're consuming or just what we're generating?
Consuming. So the renewable portfolio standards require that the people that we buy electricity from, and in our case in Maine, mostly Central Maine Power and AmeriMaine at this moment, they have and can prove that as we go to 2030, that 80% of the electricity that they purchased from the grid to supply to us is from a renewable resource. And we do that through a thing called the renewable energy credits, which essentially allow us to track those electrons, because when electrons go into the grid, they're just used by basically the closest demand. But we need to keep a track of who, meaning which states and also which energy transmission and electricity transmission and delivery systems, who is actually moving those electrons around, if you will.
All right, and
it's
kind
of complex.
We have talked about renewable energy credits, RECs, several times in this on this program, and it's not simple because big solar farms built in Maine could be supplying power, in effect, for outer state entities, and that's not going to count in a REC sense. For the state of Maine. So my guests here today are Nicole Grahowski of Ellsworth, representative from Ellsworth and a member of the Joint Standing Committee on Energy, Utilities, and Technology. And on the phone is Sophie Janeway, the Clean Energy Outreach Coordinator at NRCM. Phone number here, 469-0500 or 866-625-9378. And we are attempting to wrap up the energy legislation from this past session. We're probably not going to get through all of it in a very comprehensive way, but we want to touch on the highlights. And by all means, give us a buzz with your comment or your questions for your own particular situation. So back to LD 1711, the solar bill. The word incentivize is in there, and it refers to also by name distributed generation. And I'm personally a huge believer in distributed generation. Put it on rooftops that are already doing their environmental and stormwater damage rather than doing a clear cut and putting a big solar farm in somewhere. But so the distributed part of it I like, but how do we incentivize that? Sophie, you want to go for that one
first?
Yeah.
Well, so part of something that Nicole mentioned earlier was setting up a procurement process through the Public Utilities Commission. And essentially what this means is that the Public Utilities Commission will put out a request for proposals, and it's using a bidding process for developers to propose solar energy projects that they would build in the state of Maine. And I think that as this bill was moving forward in the public hearing, during work sessions, it was really exciting to see the number of developers, solar energy developers from in-state and from out-of-state that are excited about opportunities to build more solar energy and use competitive markets to be able to ensure that we're doing this in a cost-effective way.
And how does that become, how does that incentivize distributed generation in particular? Or is distributed a generic term for distributing it around the landscape?
Well, so distributed generation can mean solar energy that is on people's rooftops or in people's yards or smaller scale wind turbines or hydropower. But it can also mean things like community solar arrays, which are medium to large scale solar feeding energy users locally. So the way community solar works is that anybody who pays an electricity bill can buy a share in a community solar project equivalent to their level of electricity use and receive those net metering credits. So if you are somebody that doesn't own your home or you don't have the right orientation roof or, you know, it's just not particularly sunny or you can't afford the upfront costs of putting solar on your roof, community solar is an excellent opportunity to be able to take advantage of the benefits of clean energy and be a part of the clean energy transition.
All right. And we'll come back to Nicole for any additional comments on that, but we have another caller. Ivor, I think your name is, from Swans Island. You are on the air.
Hi. I was just wondering about the role of heat pumps and if you guys have a plan to get people heat pumps, because I know we're the most oil-dependent state in terms of heating in the country, I think. So I was just wondering what sort of incentives and things you're thinking about for average people to buy heat pumps.
Yep, and we're going to talk about that, and we'll do it next year, I guess. There is legislation out there to encourage 100,000 heat pumps to be installed, and I think there's something like 30,000 or maybe 35,000 deployed in the state already. Nicole, do you want to go to that one?
Sure. So we had a bill, LD 1766, which was a governor's bill that came to my committee that, as you said, has a goal of 100,000 heat pumps installed by 2025. And that is going to be overseen by the Efficiency Maine Trust, which, as you may know, deals a lot with our incentivizing energy efficiency, essentially, and changes from carbon-based to renewable energy sources. So that bill directs money to that comes from the forward capacity market, which is a whole other show probably, to go to Efficiency Maine Trust and be used to help incentivize this. And as you may know, we do have very strong incentive programs right now for both ground sourced and air sourced heat pumps, and those have different levels of efficiencies and sort of different benefits depending on, you know, your particular location, if you want to choose one of those. But those are both available through Efficiency Maine Trust now, and this will just strengthen that project and increase it to go beyond where it has been. I myself am having a hot water heat pump installed with a benefit from Efficiency Maine Trust in the next few weeks here. So that's a way that I'll be able to turn off my oil boiler for the entire summer season when I wouldn't have it on otherwise, and separate that out from my hot water heating. So
nothing more annoying than the oil boiler running
in the middle of the summer. Right. Yeah, so I'm glad to have learned more about this and to be part of this change that's happening.
Is there any plan for a change in the rebates from Efficiency Maine as part of this $100,000 heat pump goal? Or is that really up to Efficiency Maine to figure that out?
Yeah, so Efficiency Maine has a really rigorous set of standards in terms of how it spends the money that it receives through electricity ratepayers. so they have to go through a process of determining what is going to be the best way to incentivize this goal, and then that will be approved by the Public Utilities Commission as part of their triennial plan.
And I think there was a timeline of 2025 in that bill,
correct,
wasn't there? So
yep,
that's moving right along.
Yeah.
So I guess I wonder whether they are going to increase the rebates on that. The current rebate is $500 for the first one and $250 for the second one, unless it's changed in the last 24 hours. I have two at my house, and I installed one 3 years ago and lowered my oil bill, my oil consumption by 95%. Mm. And I said, well, what the heck? I'm going to put a second one in, and I did not burn any oil last winter, or summer is the matter. And I also put a hybrid hot water heater, which is a heat pump, at my house as well. And so I've jumped in feet first with all of this stuff because it just makes so much sense.
Yeah, I guess one thing I will add to that is that for, as the caller alluded to, we are an incredibly heating oil dependent state, and there's all this technology, electric vehicles, heat pumps, that are allowing us to use technology and electricity instead of using oil. And that is that, you know, what we call beneficial electrification, and is incredibly important as we transition further into the clean energy, into a clean energy future for Maine.
Right. And a related issue, because there is a fair bit of effort out there to get people to convert to natural gas. Natural gas is mostly methane, which we mentioned a moment ago is way, way more powerful as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And I personally believe, this is an opinion here, that natural gas is an appropriate bridge fuel, but ultimately we need to move off of fossil fuels because, in part, they're finite resources and they aren't going to be there forever. Let's see. We were before that call came in, we were talking about still talking about solar a little bit, and in terms of incentivizing it. So it sounds like there's going to be a bidding process through the PUC based on what Sophie was saying. But I'm still not sure I understand where the incentive part comes in. Nicole, do you have any thoughts on that?
I do have some thoughts. So part of the procurement, as Sophie mentioned, that will be done by the Public Utilities Commission states a certain amount of megawattage that we're going to need to procure. So it's 250 megawatts by July 2024. And the reason that it's not an incentive is, and you become part of this procurement and here's $100 for doing it. The incentive is that the procurement gives the company a stable rate that they will be able to sell their electricity for over a period of time. And so the incentive really is that you're making a secure business investment with the state of Maine that you will, through a power purchase agreement, be able to be guaranteed a certain amount of money over a time period. So I don't know that incentive is necessarily the right word, but it for a business, it will make sense to invest in Maine because they can be certain that their investment will pay off.
So long-term contracts is basically what it amounts to, right?
Yes. So, and one of the exciting things, I just pulled up the legislation here to remind myself about the procurements, is that they specify that a certain amount of those procurements do have to go to households that have low or moderate income that would be able to purchase from these large-scale renewable resources. And I think that's really important because these are the folks that are often most impacted by climate change and certainly maybe don't have the original capital to install their own facilities, but they could be purchasing electricity from a green source at a stable rate over a period of time. And I think it's really important that we've included that in this legislation.
Yeah, I think that I fully agree that that mentioning low and moderate income customers makes a lot of sense. And this loops back to something that we didn't pursue fully on the community solar farms issue. So community solar farms are where people buy in. Basically, it's a cooperative to buy electricity like a farm agricultural I'm not coming up with the phrase, but at any rate, what it means is that if you're a renter or somebody, as you just said a few minutes ago, that doesn't have good aspect on your solar roof, you can still buy into solar. And the renter part of it is important because, you know, what renter is going to put solar on the house where they live? It doesn't make any sense. And what that, so a community solar farm actually allows you to buy into solar, and if you move and stay within the same utility district, you retain that ability to tap into those electrons, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So community solar farms are something that that anybody really should be thinking about looking at. And it's interesting that we've gone from the 10, or actually 9, because there's a meter for the program,
right.
For community solar farms, up to an unlimited number. Do either of you know why we had that limit of 10?
I don't know, Sophie, if you know the actual answer. I think it probably has to do with when it was first created, just trying to figure it out and not wanting to overcomplicate things for the utilities. But that is, at this point, a sort of arcane number. I think I feel confident that if a utility can divide by 9 and allocate the energy savings to 9 customers, they should be able to divide really by any number.
Right, right. And presumably there's an economy of scale there, which is going to bring the price down. So one of my questions is, because we did have this period of a year or two where the CMP and PUC had a gross metering rule out there where you had to install a second meter, which meant that the potential was you being taxed for the electricity you were generating. And, you know, the analogy there, the problem is if you're growing green peppers in your yard, does the state have the right to tax you for that kind of production? Somebody who installs solar under those rules, are they staying with those rules, or can they go to a simpler net metering scenario?
No. So they, thankfully, so LD 91, which was passed earlier in the session to reverse gross metering, also requires removal of the gross meters, the extra meters that were installed to be measuring the electricity use that people were making and using in their own homes right from their solar arrays. So with LD 91 being passed, gross metering is officially a thing of the past.
But presumably the people aren't going to get a rebate for the amount of money that they paid to get those meters installed. Is that correct?
Well, so actually the costs of installing those meters was distributed amongst all ratepayers in the state of Maine. So everybody was paying for that. Nicole might have more details on
that,
I don't think.
That's what I was aware of as well. So there's a lot of things that happen to benefit, or quote-unquote benefit, the grid that we all bear the cost of, and gross metering was one of those.
Okay. I thought individuals paid for that. I didn't realize that that's the way it worked. All right. Thanks for that clarification. There's also language in LD 1711, and then we need to move on from that, about an alternative bill credit for non-residential customers. What does that refer to?
I'm happy to start that, and
okay.
Nicole might have things to fill in. But businesses particularly often pay demand charges and for electricity usage, which residents do not pay. And net metering credits could not be applied to demand charges, which was a barrier for businesses to install solar. And so what LD 1711 does is establish a new system which allows credits to go towards that demand charge to
All
make
right.
solar.
Well, that's a big
and
deal.
An easier choice, yeah.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
Nicole probably has more details on that.
Well, I think that's a great overview. Thank you, Sophie. And I want to add that in addition to businesses which might have demand charges, and demand charges really, a lot of what they exist for is the fact that you might be a periodic user of electricity, and therefore the grid needs to be built out to provide you what you need at the moment you would need the most. So we think about the Blue Hill Fair, for instance, is on the grid, and they use a lot of electricity at a very specific time period. That's true also for, you know, many of our seasonal nonprofits. I'm thinking of Kneisel Hall locally, because I actually heard from them in this process, which was really great, you know, to hear from local folks about how this legislation might affect them. And so places like this, the grid has to be able to help them receive that electricity when they need it. And so they pay money year-round, even when they're not using any electricity, to account for the fact that at some point they may need a lot. And so, as Sophie mentioned, these folks now would have an incentive to install solar because in those months when they're not using any electricity generally, or a very low level, they could still use the electricity they're creating through solar panels to offset that demand charge, which is monthly.
Right. And then, in fact, WERU is considering going solar, and demand charge is one of the things we've talked about there. And so this is a good, I'm glad I asked the question specifically so that we can go into that one with our eyes fully open. Let's pivot to heat pumps, since we had a question about that a few minutes ago. And I noticed in the legislation that it refers to LIHEAP helping with heat pump purposes and purchases. LIHEAP is low income heating, whatever that acronym may stand for. Do we know yet how that's going to work, or is that going to be something worked out by Efficiency Maine?
My understanding is that there actually is already a little bit of LIHEAP funds used for heat pumps. In particular, but this is sort of codifying that relationship between the two organizations and that it is appropriate to use those funds. So, you know, LIHEAP is helping people in their immediate needs for heating assistance, but if we think long term, we may be able to help more people with less money if we help them become more efficient in their heating use in the wintertime, especially.
Right. It seems to me that LIHEAP providing subsidies for oil heat is somewhat counterproductive, so that makes a lot of sense. Just to remind everybody, we are speaking with Nicole Grahowski of Ellsworth, representative in the Maine House, and Sophie Janeway, who is the Clean Energy Outreach Coordinator at the Natural Resource Council of Maine. I want to pivot again to electric vehicles, and I've read press releases talking about this. It's not quite clear to me what legislation it's in, and maybe that doesn't matter. But my understanding that the rules are not finalized yet, but through the Volkswagen money that came about as their cheating scandal, that we are going to have rebates for electric vehicles in Maine. I believe it's going to be 1,000 electric vehicles. Can you, Nicole, give us a little bit of more background on that?
So what I know about that, at least through my committee work, is that part of what we needed to do was to set up a fund within Efficiency Maine. So the money, as you said, is coming from VW. Money may also come from the CMP corridor project if that does go through. And now we have a fund with a structure that specifies, you know, what sort of vehicles can apply and what sort of rebate caps there will be. But again, Efficiency Maine does a lot of that work through their rulemaking. And they will, I think, make the ultimate determination of how many. I haven't heard specifically how many vehicles. I think that's probably an estimate based on what they think the rebates will be.
Probably.
But the idea would be, you know, they know how much money there is and they know what the goal is. So what is an appropriate rebate to get there? And so I think that is yet to be determined. But I don't know, Sophie, if you have any other details on that.
There are a lot of really exciting initiatives that Efficiency Maine is taking on right now pertaining to electric vehicles. And there are also a couple different bills in the legislature, both one that created a framework for this Volkswagen settlement money to be used through Efficiency Maine, and also one focusing on the benefits of electrification, both pertaining to electric vehicles and to heat pumps. But what Efficiency Maine is in the process of doing right now is creating a plan and working with a diverse group of stakeholders to implement those rebates, which they are hoping will be, we hope those will be announced this summer. And then they also have charging station grants that are available right now. And so until July 10th, people who, businesses, individuals, nonprofits, municipalities who are interested in installing electric vehicle chargers can submit an application for some of that funding.
And I believe that's a 50% offset on the cost.
It's up to, some are 50 and some are up to 80, depending on the details of your application.
Okay. One legislative act, LD 1181, could be something that could kind of go under the radar of a lot of people. It's curiously named an act to reduce electrical costs through non-wires alternatives. And my interpretation of that is that it's talking about projects such as the Booth Bay project. Nicole is nodding at me there, so that makes me feel good. Where instead of building more transmission lines, which is in our deregulated economy, CMP or Emera are likely to do because that's how they earn their money, putting in renewable energy or conservation options to reduce the load on the grid, such as distributed energy, can be a way to save consumers' money. And so this act puts a, I'm looking for the word here, I don't seem to have it, but a staff person in the public advocate's office, they're a non-wires alternative coordinator. Wouldn't you like to have that for your job? But tell us a little bit more about how that one went down through the committee, Nicole.
Sure. This one, actually, I'm glad you brought it up because it's, I think, another one of the most exciting bills that honestly got no fanfare and actually was reported out of our committee unanimously. Again, great bipartisan support. As you said, that this bill does create a position within the Office of the Public Advocate to determine if there are appropriate non-wires alternatives. So essentially, the utility, CMP or Emera mainly, would say, you know, we really need to make this grid bigger and more robust to meet the future demand needs that we see in a region. And that is something that is paid for by all of the ratepayers. But there may be times that, you know, we don't need to build to that capacity because we can take care of those peak demand times with solar, for instance, or battery storage. And so previously, my understanding is previously it was up to the utility to say, oh, yeah, we considered a non-wires alternative. And we really thought that it was more appropriate for the public advocate, who's really there to look out for the ratepayers and that they're getting a good benefit, for their office to have a separate analysis that could then go to the Public Utilities Commission and say, you know, we don't think this build-out is necessary because we have this plan to take care of the demand needs using distributed renewables, for instance. So I think this has a real opportunity to not only save us money as ratepayers, but also to get us to that renewable future that we're moving toward.
Right. And I did a project for a previous employer, Maine Technology Grant funded, that did an analysis of the potential for rooftop solar mm-hmm. in Maine. And the answer in 2012 was that rooftop solar could generate 56% of our electricity if every roof in the state that was suitably oriented had solar on it. That was back when solar panels had 240-watt capacity. Mm-hmm. If you scale it up to today's 340-watt capacity, the number comes out at almost 80% of our electricity for distributed solar. If we did that, we would lower the demand on the grid by a huge amount. I don't know if it's 80%, but by a lot.
Right.
And that's the essence of what this position is going to do. And again, I think this one flew beneath the radar, but I think it makes an awful lot of sense. Any comments on that, Sophie?
No, I really think that Nicole covered it. It's a great opportunity, and it's a great example of how we can be saving money and moving towards more clean distributed energy by looking at these alternatives. And it's great that it passed with such out of the committee, at least with unanimous bipartisan support.
And I mentioned the Booth Bay example here a moment ago, where a company called Grid Solar, led by Rich Silkman, did get the PUC to ask CMP to look at an alternative to expanding their line down in Booth Bay, and that project was saved tens of millions of dollars for CMP ratepayers. And you can learn more about that with Rich Silkman as my guest on this program back in, I think, the fall of 2017. And you can find that show at archives.weru.org if you want to learn more about that. The numbers are really quite astonishing. So last month, this program was talking about LD 1646, an act to restore local ownership and control of Maine's power authority. And it bill would have established the Maine Power Delivery Authority. Tell us where that did not come up for a vote, as I understand it. Where does that one stand, Nicole?
So actually, in the process of the public hearings, there was certainly a lot of support for the consideration of going to a consumer-owned utility from Maine. But also, you know, we all believe that we need to go in there with our eyes wide open about whether or not this will actually save ratepayers money. And that has a lot to do with how much the assets are valued at and the legal costs that might come with acquisition of that size. So we have passed legislation to basically have the Public Utilities Commission study and find out those answers for us. And we have an opportunity with the legislation that we passed to report, possibly report out a bill next year if we want to move in this direction. So I think there's a lot of interest in it from the public. I certainly have heard from many folks who understand the different sort of investment scenario as we talked about last month. And there are certainly, I mean, I'm sitting currently in CMP territory. I live in Emera territory, but I think with the recent news from CMP, I think there's a lot of public interest in other options within this regulated monopoly that we have where they, you know, a consumer cannot go to another electricity supplier. They can go off the grid. That's basically their two options. So there's definitely a lot of interest in and pursuing this, and we just want to make sure that that if we take these steps that they will save us money and that the transition can be smooth, because obviously our electricity resource is really critical to our health, well-being, and of course our economy as well. So that's sort of the progress that's happening now, is going for a deeper dive and finding out more information about what this might actually mean for Maine.
Well, and CMP certainly has been in the news lately, and mm-hmm. the news has not been good. And they've just filed yesterday, I think, for a 10% rate hike. And I actually, I think I saw in the news that there was a small rate hike went into effect just in the last week or two.
Mm-hmm.
The CMP said it would be the average bill would go up by something like a dollar, but the 10% is going to be significant more mm-hmm. than that. So it seems to me that combining that with their utility quarter, they keep trying to shoot themselves in the foot, if I could say it that way. And so your expectation is that the study will be done before the January session, and this bill could come back up for consideration at that time?
That's our hope. I mean, we've certainly we've made it clear that we are interested in acting somewhat quickly on learning these things. So hopefully we'll find out soon. We may find out that it's not economically feasible, but at least we'll have done that research, and then we can focus, as we have been focusing, on better regulating these utilities so that they provide better service and reliable service to the people
right.
of Maine.
All right. Well, my guests have been Nicole Grahowski of Ellsworth, representative from Ellsworth, and Sophie Janeway, Clean Air and Energy Outreach Coordinator at NRCM. We only touched the surface of mm-hmm. all of these things, but we'll try again another time. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
See you.